Hey, good morning, church.
Good morning. Good morning.
These I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. That's our text this morning. It's from the Bible, from the Old Testament book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 56, verse 7. We read it just now as part of our scripture reading. It's pretty good, I think. Prophet Isaiah is giving a kind of universal appeal. All those in every place who might want to come to God. That's the idea. All those who might want to come to God. Wait, even Gentiles? Yes, even Gentiles. I'll make them joyful in my house of prayer, God says. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all people. Now one wonders, of course, at the time the prophet Isaiah said all of that, how many foreigners actually heard this promise? How widely was it promulgated? But regardless, it was given. And what's interesting for our purposes this morning is that twice in the course of this prophecy, Isaiah calls the temple a house of prayer. That's pretty interesting. Not a house of worship, not a house of praise, not a house of sacrifice, though it was, in a sense, all those things. He calls it a house of prayer. That's the idea I want to talk about this morning, but to get there, I need to tell you a story. This happened in the early years of my ministry here at Second Christian Church. I've told it before. It's a small story, a tiny incident in the grand sweep of things. It was long about 1991 or 92, Sunday morning, about 8:30. One of the church leaders came looking for me and said, "We've got a request I was hoping you could weigh in on." So I went with him, and it was this couple. I knew them. They weren't members of the church, weren't attenders even, but the wife of the couple was related to some folk who were members. And the couple had kids, and whenever we had youth events, someone would often pick their kids up in the church van, in the church van back then, for the events. So the couple was known to me. Not members, not regular attenders, but member adjacent, you might say. And what they wanted was, that morning, they made up a big fat lot of breakfast tacos. Showed up at the church with their big cooler full of foil-wrapped breakfast tacos. Now, they were not, sadly, bringing delicious breakfast tacos to serve as fellowship refreshments, as a nice thank you for taking such good care of their kids so many times. No, what they wanted was, they were looking for a place to set up shop. They were looking to sell breakfast tacos, and what they wanted to know was, could they do so in our fellowship hall during Sunday school? Sell breakfast tacos to our people. In other words, this was their new side hustle. They were looking for a venue, and they thought of us. They weren't here to go to church and worship Jesus. They weren't interested in any Jesus. They were here to sell tacos. And they said they would even be happy to give the church a cut of whatever they made selling the breakfast tacos in return for us letting them use our location. Well, a little group of church leaders were having a confab about this. What should we do? What should we say? And one of the leaders said, "Well, of course we need to tell them no, of course, because the Bible says you shouldn't sell stuff at church." Now, just for future reference, so you know, you shouldn't drop a doctrinal assertion like that into a conversation where there's a theologically inclined person in the room and not expect to have to chapter and verse that stuff. I said, "What?" He said, "You know, the Bible says you're not supposed to sell stuff in the church building." Which, okay, now I'm interested in that. I'm not interested in the taco question anymore. We've got to talk about this. Where does it say that? Where in the Bible does it say that you're not supposed to sell things in the church building? Well, you know, Jesus drove the merchants out of God's house because you're not supposed to do buying and selling in the house of God. Now, that is interesting. It's false, but it's interestingly false. Because what that is an assertion of a moral imperative. You mustn't sell things in the church building, based on a particular interpretation of a story from the New Testament. Do you remember it? It's a story of the cleansing of the temple. That's what we call it. And it's a story about Jesus. Jesus drives the merchants and money changers from the house of God. Now, if you look in the Bible, all three of the synoptic gospels tell this story, which lets you know it's an important one. As the Gospel of Mark has it, Mark chapter 11, we read, "And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple." That's the story. That's the story as Mark tells it. And it's a story the early church liked a lot. They liked to hear it. They liked to tell it. I said a minute ago that it's in all three of the synoptic gospels. Synoptic is a scholarly word that means having a united viewpoint. The Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all three look at the life of Jesus from the same basic vantage. And all three of them tell the same basic story. And in the process, they tell this story. Although Mark really likes this story, he's the one who tells it in the most vivid detail. But now there's a lot of stuff we need to know if we're going to understand the story. And we need to understand the story. If for no other reason than because we're always pulling it out. Not only did the first century church like the story, but we like it too. This is one of those stories we're always using for various purposes in support of various assertions. We like to pull this story out whenever we're preaching about anger. You know, it's okay to get angry. Jesus cleansed the temple. In fact, I've heard preachers refer to this as Jesus throwing a temple tantrum. Which, you have to admit, as dad jokes go, that's a pretty good one. Temple tantrum. Although you'll notice, Mark doesn't actually say anything about Jesus' emotional state here. He doesn't say Jesus was angry. We read anger into it. I think mostly because if we were doing it, it would certainly be out of anger. But the Bible isn't as psychological as we'd like it to be, and there's not a narrator's voice saying, "And he was angry." There are other places where the writers of the Bible do describe Jesus as getting angry. This isn't one of them. But there's so much going on in this story that we really have to be careful to understand. Because if we don't, we'll misunderstand and we'll be applying it to tacos. You may think, well, but that's a fine application. The tacos, they shouldn't be trying to sell tacos in the church on Sunday. But if this story really means you can't sell things in the church building, well, then our drink machine needs to go. Because we're selling cold drinks in the church building. Oh no, not the drink machine. I love the drink machine. In fact, I'll just tell you, because this isn't an isolated thing, people really have thought that this story means you can't buy and sell things in the church building. I've been in churches where they worried about whether a Girl Scout could bring her cookie order form to Sunday school, and they insisted that, well, okay, she can bring the order form and people can order, but then the actual money had to change hands in the parking lot like a drug deal. No buying and selling in the church building. Not even Girl Scout cookies? But Girl Scout cookies are delicious. In fact, I can remember a particular weekday many years ago. It was me and the church secretary in the building, Alice. Some of you remember Alice. And Alice was getting the newsletter together, and Alice had a helper, a retired lady named Mildred. who'd come and help her fold the newsletter. And Mildred had shown up, and they'd done their folding. And I happened to be in Alice's office toward the end of the day, and Mildred was getting ready to leave, gathering her things, and she asked Alice if she could buy a stamp from the church office. She had a bill she needed to mail off. Some of you remember when we used to mail our bills off. And she wanted a postage stamp, didn't want to have to schlep all the way to the post office to buy one stamp. Alice, would you sell me a postage stamp? And Alice had to consult with me as the preacher. Jeffrey, would it be okay if I sold Mildred a postage stamp? And I was confused. What? Why do I care if you sell her a postage stamp? Why, you ask, Alice, is this because of the money changers? That's not what that story's about. Well, I was just worried. She was worried. And I mean, I appreciate her point. Because if the purpose of the cleansing of the temple is to teach us that there should be no buying or selling in the church building, then that means no buying or selling. Not a taco or a Girl Scout cookie or a soft drink on a Sunday, and not a postage stamp during the week, if that's what it means. So the real question is that what it means? Does the temple cleansing actually mean that? And if not, what does it mean? How can we know? Well, we might ask Jesus, since he's the one who did it, and also he's the Son of God, so he's inspired and stuff. Did Jesus explain himself? Did he say what he actually meant by it? Because, yeah, we can stick our own interpretations all over his actions, but if he elucidated in words, that would really help. Particularly because, if we're careful readers, we'll notice that this wasn't even the first time he'd done it. What do I mean? Well, like I said, all three of the synoptic gospel writers record this story, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But the Gospel of John, which is not synoptic, the Gospel of John also records a story about Jesus cleansing the temple. That story is in John chapter 2. It happened right at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, right after his miracle of turning water into wine. Jesus had gone up to Jerusalem for the Passover, just like in Mark. He finds people buying and selling money changers, just like in Mark. And he drives them out, just like in Mark. But you'll notice Mark chapter 11, and in Matthew and in Luke, when they tell the story, it isn't at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. When is it? It's at the end. It's the last week of his earthly life, Monday after Palm Sunday. And there are those, I've heard them, who will try to use this to say, see, contradictions in the Bible. The Bible is full of contradictions. John says the cleansing of the temple happened at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. The synoptics say it was at the end. Somebody's confused. Get your story straight. Or, it was a thing Jesus did more than once. I mean, it's not like that's a thing you can only do the one time. And in fact, what we know from history is that it took more than one temple cleanse to discourage the money changers and the merchants. They just move right back in. So it's quite possible that Jesus did this once at the beginning to kick off his ministry, and again 2 years later to wrap up his ministry. That's very possible. In fact, I have heard it speculated, I don't know about this, pure speculation, but I'm kind of entertained by it, so I'm going to let it stand. I've heard it speculated that this might have been something that Jesus did every time he went to Jerusalem. Little one-man personal war. I find that far-fetched, but I give it to you for free. I like the idea that he just was always doing that, and finally that was the last time they wanted to see it. But on the occasion of that first temple cleansing at the beginning of his ministry, what Jesus said was, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade. And that's worth hearing.
course, we remember that John actually recorded this in Greek, and we read it in English translation. And in Greek, what Jesus says is, don't make my Father's house an emporium house. Oikon emporiou. And it's more than a little sarcasm. It's like as if in modern language he were saying, you're turning the temple into a Trader Joe's. I mean, that's what we're talking about. But by the time he gets to the end of his ministry, any humor, any sarcasm have been worn right out of him. And what Mark says is, and he was teaching them and saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. And I hope you notice there that there's our phrase from the book of Isaiah, house of prayer. But Jesus is quoting Isaiah. He says, it is written. When he says, a house of prayer for all nations. It's a quote. You know, a lot of times we think Jesus is being so original, and it's just because we don't know our Bibles well, so we don't realize he's quoting from the Old Testament. And I will just tell you this, that if this were an hour-long Sunday school class, if I had the time, I would take you through a timeline of the temple from when Solomon built it in 960 BC to when it was destroyed by the Babylonians, 586 BC, rebuilt by Zerubbabel in 516 BC. That's a thing people don't always realize, by the way, that the first temple that Solomon built was destroyed. The temple Jesus is in is the second temple. Second temple. You'll sometimes hear the religion of the time of Jesus referred to as Second Temple Judaism. That's why. And we could talk also then in detail about how King Herod the Great started a huge renovation program in 37 BC, which is why this is sometimes referred to as Herod's Temple. None of that do we really have time for, except to say the first temple was, in fact, destroyed. And why? Well, Jesus actually refers to it in what he says. Remember, Mark says that Jesus says, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. When he says den of robbers, again, he's quoting. In this case, that phrase den of robbers is from the prophet Jeremiah. I love that Jesus takes a quote from Isaiah, a house of prayer for all nations, and a quote from Jeremiah, den of robbers, and just jams them together. That's good preaching. But see, back during the time of the first temple, God had told Jeremiah to go down to the temple and stand in the gate of it and prophesy a warning against the people in the temple. And it's long. Typical of Jeremiah. Jeremiah can't say anything short. And again, if this were an hour-long Sunday school class, we would read the whole thing. But in it, Jeremiah says, has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I myself have seen it, declares the Lord. And he warns them. If they don't stop what they're doing, God is going to allow their city and their temple to be destroyed. Which, of course, happened. So when Jesus uses that same language, den of robbers, for a second temple, he's reminding them, hey, guys, God did it before. He can do it again. And by the way, if you know your history, you know that exactly what Jesus warned of happened 40 years later. The Romans came and destroyed the temple, the second temple, in the year AD 70. But still, we haven't answered the question, what is it that Jesus was actually objecting to? What was it they were doing? Well, to understand that, we need a little temple geography. We have to understand where in the second temple we are. See, right here, this, That's the temple proper, the holy place, the actual building where the priests did their stuff. And this whole area here is called the court of the priests. And only priests could go in there, nobody else. Now this long, slim area was called the court of Israel. Any Israelite man could go in here. This is as close as ordinary Jewish men who weren't priests could get to God. This part here was called the court of the women. Jewish women could worship there. I'm sorry about that, but that's how they did women back in those days. In fact, the whole area around it, the whole rest of that area, this was called the court of the Gentiles. And it had been put there because of a good impulse. Because, in fact, what the builders of the second temple had read was that prophecy in Isaiah. Because, like Jesus said, the original mandate for the temple had been a house of prayer for all the nations, for all people. In fact, back when Solomon was building that first temple, Solomon himself had envisioned the temple as a sort of lighthouse of prayer for the whole world. Just read that dedication prayer that Solomon prayed for the temple in 1 Kings chapter 8. Again, it's long. If this were a Sunday school class, we could read the whole thing. But for now, I'm just going to highlight. Solomon says to God, God, I know we're going to call this your house, but the reality is you are too big to live in a temple. Even the highest heaven can't contain you. But Lord, I know that you have chosen this place as the place to put your name and to be prayed to. Priests are going to go in and out of the temple, but your people Israel are going to stand outside of the temple and pray towards it. And when they do, God, please hear. And then Solomon says, likewise, when a foreigner who is not of your people Israel comes from a far country, for your name's sake, for they shall hear of your great name and your mighty hand and of your outstretched arm. When he comes and prays toward this house, hear in heaven your dwelling place, and do according to all which the foreigner calls to you, in order that all the people of the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your people Israel. And that they may know that this house that I have built is called by your name. Did you know that was in the Bible? That's in the Bible. That's why Isaiah said what he said in our text this morning. These I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. Isaiah was bought in on what we might call Solomon's outreach agenda. Isaiah was saying what he said. This temple needs to have a universal appeal to it. And so, when the second temple was being built after the first temple was destroyed, the builders had said, the Gentiles need their own court. The Gentiles need to have a place for them. And well, ambitiously, they said, you know, there's a lot more of them than there are of us, so it should be big. The court of the Gentiles should be the biggest court. And that was cool. Except, I mean, you know how it is. Just because you build it doesn't mean they'll come. And it turned out that there weren't that many Gentiles as all of that turning up out of the blue to worship at the temple. And what with one thing and another, and real estate prices being what they are, land being somewhat scarce on the Temple Mount, by the time of Jesus, the leadership in the temple, Sadducees mostly, They made an executive decision to repurpose their space. Merchants and money changers. Well, they were a far more efficient and economically sound use of the square footage. But now I have to say this. It's very easy for us to get a bony finger up and get all in the face of the Jewish people. How dare you? But honestly, it would take some real faith and fortitude, year after year, decade after decade, to have all of that space just sitting there and quote-unquote not being used. Going out to tell unbelievers about the wonderful God of Jacob and call them in? That's hard. Repurposing real estate? That's easy. And it's not like they weren't using it for a good purpose, a genuinely religious purpose. That's what we have to understand. These weren't just any merchants and money changers. Let's talk for a minute about the merchants and money changers. Why were they there? They weren't just hanging out. They weren't just some guys looking to make a buck. It wasn't like it was a strip mall. See, if you read your Old Testament, the law of Moses required that every adult male once a year pay a special contribution of 1/2 shekel that was to go to the upkeep and maintenance of the temple. You can read that law, Exodus chapter 30. If you want to go home and read it, that can be your Christian homework, Exodus 30. That's about $200 in today's money, by the way. About $200 once a year. And a rich person wasn't allowed to give more for himself. And a poor person wasn't allowed a discount. It was one of the great ideas of the Torah. That when they stand before God, everybody in Israel is worth the same. Although, also, to pay the temple 1/2 shekel on behalf of someone else was considered a righteous act. So quite often, fathers would pay it for their sons, masters would pay it for their servants, employers would pay it for their employees, so on and so forth. But 1/2 shekel for every man, no more, no less. Well, how can we make sure that everybody pays the same thing? Standardize the currency, of course. But that was a problem. So you have to picture, it wasn't like here in the U.S. where there's the one standard United States currency. The money situation was extremely fluid. There were, at the time of Jesus, like 7 different competing currencies in use, can you imagine? There was the local Palestinian coin from up in Samaria, mostly copper. But there was also copper and silver coins from Persia, from Syria, Egypt, Greece, and Rome. There was also, most importantly, coins from the mint in the city of Tyre. I say most importantly because those were the coins that the authorities in the temple had decided were the ones that would be accepted for paying the temple 1/2 shekel so that everybody was paying the same. So if you wanted to pay your temple money and you didn't have Tyrian shekels or 1/2 shekels, you had to convert your money. You had to. So, money changers. They were in the business of changing the coinage. Licensed money changers. And for every exchange they made, they were licensed to charge a 1/6 of the total value above and beyond. So it cost 1/6 of a shekel to change a shekel. Imagine if the bank fee for changing a 20 was $3.50. That's about the right mental picture. It's like about the same magnitude as a really annoying ATM fee. And the thing is, the temple 1/2 shekel was paid at Passover time. So long about 2 weeks before Passover, the money changers would all set up shop in the temple so that all the Passover pilgrims coming into town from all over the country and all around the Roman world could change their foreign money for the temple 1/2 shekel. I mean, it needed to be done. The money changers could legitimately say they were providing a needed service, a service people wanted them to provide. They could even tell themselves they were doing God's work. They were helping. The only problem was they were doing it in a place that was supposed to be for people to pray. And the merchants, the buying and selling, well, of course, you know, there was a whole system of sacrifices, lambs and bulls and goats. And yes, some people, when they came to the temple, they would bring their own sacrifices. But the thing is, there were strict requirements for the health and quality of the animals being sacrificed. You couldn't sacrifice a sick animal or a lame animal, a starved animal, a deformed animal. You couldn't do it. So they had to be inspected. And so you had to pay the inspector, of course. He didn't work for free. And then, what if it turned out that your animal wasn't good enough? What if he turned it down for some reason? So, for convenience sake, what most people did was they wait until they got to Jerusalem, and they would just buy their sacrifice there. That way, you could even buy a sacrifice that had already passed inspection and been certified good. No risk, no uncertainty. So again, the merchants could tell themselves they were providing a needed service, a service people wanted. They could tell themselves, I'm doing God's work, I'm helping. And if they filled the court of the Gentiles with animal noises and bargaining and the smell of manure, well, that's just the price of doing business. If, in the process, since they were the ones in charge, the family of the high priests, well, you know, they were the actual owners of record of the market stalls, and all the buyers and sellers worked for them, which, by the way, that's what history tells us. Well, someone's got to own those businesses. And if they were raking in money hand over fist because they were the only show in town and had a monopoly and could charge what they wanted, well, people didn't have to buy from them. They were just taking advantage of people's desire for convenience. You know, it's just like the markup at the convenience store or, you know, at the stand at the movies. This is, in fact, why we read what we read in the Gospel of Mark. When the chief priests and the scribes heard it and were seeking a way to destroy him, for they feared him, because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. I'm just going to tell you in general, if you want to know what a story about Jesus means in the Bible, all you have to do is look to see who it made mad. That's a pretty good metric. In fact, what it turns out that this story is really about isn't buying and selling in the church building. It wasn't about shekels or cattle, any more than it was about stamps, sodas, Girl Scout cookies, or tacos. Because what mattered wasn't the building. What mattered was what was supposed to be happening in it. What mattered, in fact, was the usual suspects. On the one hand, the in crowd, who had all the power, could make the rules and decide the plan and set the tone. And on the other hand, people far from God who might want to draw near. See, what the priesthood of Jesus' day had done was prioritized their comfort, their convenience, over actual human beings who were far from God. What they had done was that they had valued profit more than people. What they had done, in fact, was let their national and ethnic pride trump their desire to see God honored among the Gentiles. So what's my point? Well, this is the second sermon in a series about prayer, calling it Raising Holy Hands. It's a series within a series, because all year long I've been preaching this series of series about the various things the church does when we gather together, like we are this morning. And so we've had a series about baptism and a series about the Lord's Prayer or the Lord's Supper. We had a sermon, one, about the greeting time, a series about the singing, a series about the preaching, all the things we do. And right now, this is a series about praying, specifically about praying together. See, one of the important concepts in the New Testament about the church is that what the temple was in the Old Testament, the church is today. Did you know that? What the temple was in the Old Testament, the church is today. A third temple, if you will. The church is a temple. Not the building, the people. You are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole structure, being joined together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord. In him you also are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit. But what that means, if whatever the temple was in the Old Testament, the church is today, what that means, whatever else we may be, what that means is we're a house of prayer. We're meant to be a house of prayer. And there are two things I don't know about this. First of all, I don't know that we've always given prayer the priority it deserves. Last week when I was preaching about this, we heard the Apostle Paul's words, "First of all, then I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all people." And that phrase, "for all people," is Paul quoting Isaiah. It's Paul quoting from our text this morning, because Paul had also read Isaiah. I mean, look at that. That's a tall order. Supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings for all people? All people? A tall order. And I don't know about you, but it makes me want to be better at prayer. I have never felt like prayer is my strong suit. Some of you know that about me. You've heard me complain about it before. And I know, no one person can be good at everything. But I wish I was better at prayer. I want to be better at prayer. And hearing Isaiah's words, "These I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer," makes me want to be better at prayer. But Isaiah also says there, "For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples." And that's the part that seems to have made Jesus start flipping tables and such. That in the house of prayer, people who were far from God weren't being made to feel welcome for prayer. And see, this is the part that really intrigues me. Because as designed, the space in the temple for Gentiles to come in and pray was bigger than all the other spaces. The builders of that temple had gone out of their way to make plenty of room for people who were far from God. And I don't know that the church is always good at making plenty of room for people who are far from God. But I want us here at Second Christian Church to be good at doing that. To be good at making room for people who are far from God. You know, interestingly, the idea was when Gentiles came to the temple to pray,
There weren't any preconditions. You know, Gentiles, they had some habits and some customs and some behaviors that weren't precisely in accordance with the Word of God. Weren't precisely to the taste of the Israelites, you could say. They didn't dress like people of God. They didn't talk like people of God. They didn't act like people of God. You know why? Because they weren't people of God. They were far from God. But the gate of the temple was open to them. And nobody was stationed at the gate of the temple with an instruction manual saying, here's how you have to change your habits, customs, and behaviors before you can come in and pray. There wasn't a form they had to sign promising that they wouldn't eat any more bacon and shrimp. Didn't have to swear that they'd grow their side curls out. In fact, you know what? They didn't even have to agree that they'd never worship an idol again. They just had to come in and pray. The bar was very low. And what the leadership in Jerusalem was doing that got Jesus to the point where he was throwing people out of the temple, what the leadership in Jerusalem was doing was raising the bar, making the bar high. Well, you can come in, but we're not going out of our way to make it comfortable for you. We're going to make sure you know this space is our space and not your space. And you'll have to watch where you stand and you'll have to watch where you step. Now, we have a nice courtyard in there, and you can see into it, but it's for us, not for you. If you want to pray in there, you have to become one of us first. And what I want to say this morning is this. Maybe you feel like you're far from God. If you feel like you're far from God, this is a house of prayer for all people. God's goal is not to keep you out. God's goal is to make you joyful in his house of prayer. You are welcome. You're welcome. You don't have to mend yourself or change yourself. All you have to do is come in and pray. Let's do that right now. I'm thankful, God, for this temple. And I am thankful for the way that on days when I have felt far from you, that I found myself welcomed in. Father, we come as your people today confessing that there have been times in our life together when we have, whether intentionally or unintentionally, made people feel excluded from the courts of your house. Forgive us, Lord. Help us to remember it's not our job to change anybody.